The Cultural and Outdoor Resources Finance Division will come to order. We are continuing our agenda with the responses to the Governor's Supplemental Budget Recommendations. And we are going to start tonight with Explore Minnesota Tourism. Mr. Edmond. Second on the agenda tonight is the Association of Minnesota Public and Education Radio Stations, known to us more as AMPRS. We're starting with Jim Gullickson. Third item on the agenda tonight is public television. And presenting the response to the Governor's Supplemental Budget Recommendations, Al Harmon, Minnesota Public Television Association from Duluth, Bill Sanford, General Manager of Lakeland Public Television, Bemidji, Les Heen, General Manager, Pioneer Public Television, Appleton. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Thanks for being first on the agenda.
Thank you, Representative Murphy, committee members. I would like the record to reflect that we do hit our time cues. Representative Murphy, committee members, I'm Alan Harmon, General Manager of WDSC-WRPP, the public television stations that serve Duluth and Hibbing, and also President of the Minnesota Public Television Association. With me this afternoon is Mr. Bill Sanford, of Lakeland Public Television, serving Bemidji and Brainerd, and Les Heen, of Pioneer Public Television, serving Appleton and southwestern Minnesota. We are happy to be here this evening representing America's most trusted media source. I can make that claim based on the findings of a recently released study by the Roper Organization that confirmed that for 7 years, public television has been America's most trusted media source. Also in that study, and you have copies of the information and the information that's been distributed, was a finding that Americans find their investment in public television the second best use of their tax dollars, second only to national defense. That means that Americans found public television a better use of tax dollars than such essential services as police, fire, the judiciary, public education. Ironically, that survey result was released in the same week that the governor decided to propose a budget that eliminated funding for public television. From that perspective, we would like to address the committee and share what elimination of those funds means for public television in Minnesota and for the services that we provide Minnesotans. The budget items being eliminated are core operating dollars. They pay expenses for things like utilities, operating engineers, replacement parts that the stations require to operate regardless of the size of the area that they serve or the population that they serve. These reductions come on top of a reduction from the previous biennium of $1 million for public television. The impact of these reductions is amplified by the loss of matching dollars, also dollars used for central operations, through a complex formula that means the impact on each of the stations will vary, but Mr. Heen will address the examples of how that will work for Pioneer Public Television in a moment. Without these funds, cuts in services in our communities and for your constituents are inevitable. Ultimately, it means cuts in jobs. For my station, the amount of the cuts represents 10% of our total budget, but 20% of our personnel budget. That means we're likely to lose three positions and won't be able to do programming like candidate forums, our doctor's call-in shows, our garden's call-in shows, our high school art and essay contests that this year drew 1,200 entries from 24 area high schools, or our Young Writers and Illustrators contest that last year drew 4,000 entries from K-3 schools across our service area. For Austin, the smallest of our stations, the cuts represent nearly 20% of the budget and means that they will have to eliminate a number of locally produced programs that deal with everything from local development to health connections to farming and agriculture, diversity, and their foreign language programs such as Entre Amigos. For the largest of our stations, Twin Cities Public Television here in the metro, 13 have already been laid off in the past 2 years. And the cuts that these dollars will require will mean significant loss to those programs that do not receive grant funding from other sources. Programs like Almanac at the Capitol, programs serving minorities, and education and health and safety programming. Mr. Sanford will address the impact of these cuts on Lakeland Public Television.
Mr. Sanford.
Thank you. Representative Murphy and committee members, thank you for your time today. Really appreciate it. Drove down from Bemidji today. It's a long drive, about 4 hours to get here. Happy to do so. Just want to talk a little bit about Lakeland Public Television and the area that we serve. We serve a very large geographic area of the state, basically from about Little Falls all the way up to the Canadian border, kind of in the center of the state. So huge area. We serve some of the poorest counties in the state, Clearwater County, lots of counties where people are just struggling to make ends meet. You know, as I'm visiting with folks up in our area, I hear more and more people, you know, because of loss of jobs and whatnot, they drop cable, they drop satellite, and they're relying more on public television. And the state invested significantly in our digital conversion for the over-the-air. And these operating dollars are what allow us to keep the wheels turning and stay on the air. And these folks are relying on us for their news, for their information, help educate their kids. They look forward to public television. It's basically a lot of these folks, that's all they can get. If the governor's elimination of funding indeed does pass, Lakeland would be looking at cutting local programming like Lakeland News at 10 and potentially eliminating our kids' channel because we program that locally. This would mean that we would end up eliminating about five full-time people in Bemidji and two in Brainerd in our news operation. And again, that's a nightly newscast. It's the only local news in our area of the state. Nobody else is doing any kind of local television news at all when you get up north in that area. In fact, in a lot of the area that we serve in our northern half of our coverage area, Lakeland's about the only station, period, that people can get over the air. In addition, state funding brings federal matching dollars into not only Lakeland, but all the states in MPTA. And the cuts that the governor's proposing would be magnified by loss of federal funding as well. So it hits us doubly hard.
How much loss of federal money?
It really depends. It isn't a straight dollar-for-dollar match, but there is a threshold for smaller stations. If we fall below that threshold, all of a sudden we're not eligible for federal funding, period. That would mean for Lakeland over $600,000 annually. So it could be extremely significant. You know, the problem is that it's sort of a ripple effect. Let's say we cut our local news. Well, we generate a lot of underwriting, local support around our local news as well. We're going to lose that. Between that and the loss of the state funding and maybe other losses, we could fall below that threshold for federal funding. So it's extremely serious. You know, we realize that the budget situation is really tight, and we want to do our part, too, and we're willing to take our share. But it seems like elimination is pretty harsh. We're kind of getting zeroed out. You know, we understand. I mean, we know what's happening, especially, you know, up north in the areas that I serve. The economy has never been bad up there, but people are hurting up there, too. So, again, I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak and let you know a little bit about Lakeland Public Television. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
So you do this 10 o'clock news every night?
Yes, we do, Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock. And we also do a 6 o'clock, a little update at 6. But the 10 is a full half-hour newscast. And, again, we're the only ones doing any kind of local news in that entire area. I think Representative Howes was on the committee, but I don't see him here today. But Larry
Howes. He'll be here.
Okay.
probably.
Larry understands our local news, and you chat with him about it. He understands the value that we bring to that area. So.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To any of the witnesses, do you cover the legislative channel?
Yes, we do. We cover it gavel to gavel. We pick up that Minnesota channel. It's one of our digital channels, and we've got very good cable carriage up in our area of that channel as well.
Mr. Harmon.
Madam Chair, Les Heen would like to discuss the impact of the cuts on Pioneer Public Television.
Okay, but I wanted you to answer Representative Erdahl's question.
I'm sorry. With respect to legislative coverage, all the Minnesota Public Television Association stations carry the fee on the legislature.
Okay. Mr. Heen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Pioneer Public Television also, like Lakeland, serves a rural area. We are headquartered in Appleton, and with transmitters near Chandler in the southwestern corner of the state and near Fergus Falls, we reach an area roughly from Laverne and Jackson all the way to north of Detroit Lake. So that's about one-fourth of the state. Very rural and, of course, affected by a troubled economy. The proposed cuts, I know Mr. Sanford talked about the impact on Lakeland. The proposed cuts for Pioneer and the governor's proposal amount to $223,000. That's roughly 13% of our annual budget and roughly 33% of our annual payroll. The governor's proposed cut would mean, we believe, the loss of approximately 5 jobs in Appleton. And I mention that it's in Appleton specifically because our community is already reeling, as many of you know, from the loss of our largest employer. The prison in town that employed more than 300 people a few years ago, as of one month ago, now has 7 employees. So 5 jobs in Appleton is a big deal. The cut for Pioneer would also put us in a position similar to Lakeland in that it could jeopardize federal funding because, as Mr. Sanford mentioned, we too could fall below the federal threshold. That is one of our concerns, which could lead to a loss of comparable funds of $600,000 if we fell that far down. We do not do local daily news at Pioneer the way that they do at Lakeland. However, we do some public affairs programming. I know that a number of members of the committee, I'm sure, are familiar with our program, Your Legislators, which is carried on about half of the state live and the other half of the state tape delayed. And that public affairs call-in program has been around for 28 years. I expect that program would be on the chopping block, as well as probably Prairie Sportsman and Prairie Yard and Garden, to give a couple of other examples of programs that we do on a regular basis, plus less common programs such as town hall meetings and that sort of thing. We understand the need for cuts. Of course, we've mentioned that, and we understand that the legislature is facing difficult decisions, but we believe that 100% cut is simply too much. I don't want to repeat a lot of the testimony that's already been given by Mr. Sanford and Mr. Harmon. I just wanted to share a little bit about how these cuts can specifically affect Pioneer. So with that, I'll just welcome any questions you may have.
If you meet the threshold for the federal government of the 600, is the threshold 600,000?
The threshold is 800,000 of non-federal financial support, and state funding counts towards that.
Okay, so you have to have 800,000, and then if you do that, you get 600,000.
We get a base grant plus some matching dollars, yes, but you have to hit that threshold before you get the base grant, before you're eligible for any of it.
Okay, and all of you are eligible in the same way?
Yes.
Okay, is TPT 2?
Yes.
Okay.
It's not an issue for them.
Okay. Now, does your annual asking people to phone in or their amounts of money that they are willing to donate, does that match with the feds?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Yeah, anything we raise locally, which would be underwriting dollars, memberships, yes.
Okay, and
just to give you an idea, too, our budget size at Lakeland is about $2 million.
Okay.
So a cut of the size the state's talking about, $230,000, is pretty, pretty significant. And basically, that amount is kind of what I guess we'd call our discretionary money that we can actually have some real control over. And we invest that in local news. We invest it in a public affairs program that we do out of our Brainerd studio. All those kinds of things would go away because to be a PBS member, it's not like pick and choose. You're either a PBS member or you're not.
You're right.
So you want to join the game, here's what you pay. And you know, and then we've got electric bills and insurance for towers, and there's so many fixed costs, just like running state government, that it's difficult to trim. And the few areas that we've got are local programming. That's discretionary whether we do that or not. Mm-hmm. And I think it's one of the most important things. So it's a difficult thing to have to look at.
Okay, Mr. Harmon, what about what do you raise?
Our budget is slightly larger than Lakeland or Pioneer. It will be about $2.5 million this year.
And about what's your service area? How many people are in your service area, Mr. Sanford?
We serve about 400,000 people over the air.
Mr. Harmon?
We serve 175,000 households, which, if my math is correct, translates into about 425,000 individuals.
Okay. And Mr. Heen?
Approximately 400,000 as well. And our annual budget is approximately $1.7 million. So a little smaller than Duluth or Lakeland.
But you have a gardening show and a prairie yards?
Madam Chair, Prairie Yard and Garden, which has been on the air for about 20 years. It's produced in cooperation with the University of Minnesota Morris.
Okay. And what's your most listened to local program, Mr. Harmon?
The ratings for several of our programs are very, very close to the same. So the most viewed would be our Doctors on Call-in program, our gardening program, and our Friday evening public affairs program on that.
Okay. And Mr. Sanford?
It's our news program, Lakeland News at 10, is very popular. We do an annual preference poll of our members where they can vote on the different programming, and it helps us decide what to put on the air. And that program ranks second behind Antiques Roadshow overall of all the programs that we broadcast. So it's very popular.
Okay. But if it's the only news they have,
that's right.
The choice of that's why they would be watching at 10 o'clock, huh? Because where else do they get?
Local news would be newspaper or radio. There's no other television.
So there's no other television.
No.
So they don't get Channel 10 from Duluth or.
Well, they may get it on cable, but Channel 10 from Duluth doesn't come over and cover anything in our area.
Yeah, so. And so they.
Same with the Twin Cities. You know, they're up for a big massacre, murder, or something like that.
Yeah.
But they're not covering school board meetings and events like that in the community.
And the pancake breakfast.
That's right.
Okay. Do you partner in any way with the K-12 institutions other than the, Mr. Harmon, you mentioned the contests that you have with students, and that must be with the public school or with the local school districts?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Mr. Sanford?
We certainly do. In fact, in Brainerd, we do a public affairs program Thursdays, and the crew for that public affairs program is from the media program at the Brainerd High School. So they run camera and do different things and help us with that. In addition, we send out weekly emails to the teachers in the area, letting them know about what programs are coming up and what might be relevant to work with in their classrooms. And so certainly we partner with K-12. And we're on the university campus, Bemidji State, and again, we partner with the university in comm labs and internships, and so there's lots of opportunities for education through public television.
Right. Mr. Heen?
Through our partnership with the University of Minnesota Morris, we have aired a program called Academic Challenge that features seasonally, features local high schools in a sort of a knowledge bowl type competition. We've also worked with the Southwest West Central Service Cooperative and made programs available to them so that they can distribute those as needed. And we're in consultation with them right now on the possibility of a Teaching American History grant that they're working on, because we want to be able to provide programs to them as needed that might fit in with their grants.
Did you know that you were going to be cut? In the supplemental budget proposal, that you were going to be, it was going to be suggested that we don't fund you? Mr. Harmon?
Certainly, Madam Chair, we anticipated that there would be some adjustment going forward given the state's fiscal situation, but there was no communication from the governor to indicate that there was any cuts intended or any number noted.
Mr. Sanford?
I think what Al said, one thing to note that was kind of interesting is, and Bill Straczynski pointed this out when the budget came out, the font and the text looked really different over public television. It looked like maybe the department staff had put together a budget and then somebody in the governor's office maybe pasted something different over the top or something, but we found that kind of interesting.
An addendum?
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
Ms. Barando? How are they notified? Just in the governor's, in the release that the governor made?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And what was some of the discussion that went by with that they could get along without this money?
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of any specific discussions, but I know the governor had a huge target to meet and he had to make some very difficult decisions.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
If you could, and anyone that loses federal money, if you could put in writing so I know that my notes are correct, what the federal money is that you are going to be not eligible for because we don't have the state matching money for. We would appreciate that. And the number of jobs.
Madam Chair, you'll find much of that information in the handout. We will revise it to include it in federal dollars.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Explore Minnesota Tourism, Mr. Edmond. Oh, just for a minute. In our packets, there's a letter from the Mille Lacs Band of Chippewa Indians that talks to about the importance of public broadcasting to the Mille Lacs Band of Chippewa Indians. And I think it's in all of your packets. It's from Chief Executive Officer Marge Anderson. Thank you. Mr. Edmond? Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before the television guys leave, I was wondering when they present more detailed information, if they could also include a rough outline of their other income sources.
Yes. Other income sources.
We will do that. I would also remind you that we make an annual report to the Department of Administration on that.
Thank you.
Mr. Edmond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, my name is John Edmond. I'm Director of Explore Minnesota Tourism. In the brief time here that I will be before you, I'll attempt to just kind of give you an overview of the Governor's proposed reductions, as well as to answer the specific questions that you asked us to address here today. But as Director of Explore Minnesota Tourism, we're a separate agency. We're not part of a larger agency whose mission is to promote travel to and within the state of Minnesota. Tourism itself is an $11 billion industry with representing over 245,000 jobs in just about every corner of the state. About 16% of all state sales tax and 10% of all private sector employment comes from the leisure and hospitality industry. I just wanted to give you that brief foundation. Now, our budget from which the reductions are being proposed, our annual budget is about $9.1 million. That's $8.6 million in general fund appropriation and about $500,000 in an incentive. Our budget also includes $1.7 million in pass-throughs, including $325,000 for the film board operations and $1.2 million for the Snowbait program. So the total annual budget for Explore Minnesota Tourism is about $10.8 million in fiscal year 10. Now, specifically to your questions and getting to the proposed reductions, the governor recommended a $238,000 reduction for Explore Minnesota Tourism operations in fiscal year 10 and a $300,000 reduction in fiscal year 11. Basically, to sum it up, this reduction would mean decreased marketing of the state of Minnesota. We had absorbed these reductions through a variety of different things. We looked at all of our programs throughout all units within Explore Minnesota Tourism. We'd end up reducing partnerships, restructuring some work, not filling some vacant positions, reducing distribution costs, providing more information online, reducing printing costs, holding research, reducing some IT costs and phone costs. So basically, it's across the board. Every unit of the organization, just like any business has been asked to do, has been looked at how we would absorb those reductions. As the governor's budget also includes a specific line regarding an innovative grant program. The governor had recommended $47,000 reduction in this program, actually zeroing it out. But I'd just like to point out that we would continue to maintain our normal grant program to communities throughout the state. Those would not be impacted by these proposed recommendations, and we'd reevaluate this, which is one of our more competitive portions of our grant program. In addition to these operational cuts, the governor also recommended a reduction for the Minnesota Film and TV Board. He proposed reducing the film production jobs program by $700,000 in fiscal 10 and eliminating the operational budget by $325,000 in fiscal 11. The reduction in these and the Snowbait dollars would obviously increase the incentive for films to come to Minnesota, film and TV production in Minnesota. And I believe that someone from the film board may be talking to you a little bit more detail about the impact of that. I think you asked specifically the recommendations that we did not suggest at Explore Minnesota Tourism. Basically, our recommendations was in keeping with the directions we got from management and budget to look at what would be a reduction in 3 or 6% of our unspent dollars at the end of the calendar year. And so we based our reductions on those basic instructions to find out where we could come up with those dollar amounts. The Film and TV Board, we prepared a similar recommendation about the 3 and 6% cuts. We worked with the Film Board and passed on their recommendations to the governor for that specific amount of 3 or 6%. And I guess I just want to make the point that we did not recommend the elimination of the jobs production program. This was something that came later as the governor is trying to reduce costs across the board. I think you asked a question regarding alternative cuts, and we don't have actually any alternative cuts to recommend to what has been proposed. And I guess the reason is that we are currently ranked as the 29th largest tourism office in the country, down from 25th. We've been reduced year after year, and we're willing to do our part, I think, as the previous testifier mentioned, but I'm not necessarily ready to offer cuts beyond that, because it's very hard to compete with our competitors throughout the country. If you look at our neighbors and some of our major competitors, Michigan, Illinois, South Dakota, Michigan, Illinois, Missouri, those states, even the city of Eau Claire spends more money to market tourism than we do here in Minnesota, in Wisconsin.
Where do they get their money?
Well, it's a lodging tax, frankly, is what it is.
Their lodging tax gives them more money than what you're able to spend.
We're unfortunately, as you all know, competing with limited general fund dollars, and there's just only so many general fund dollars to go around. And I believe in the value of return on investment. I really believe in what we're doing. It brings in new dollars to the state. But you're faced with some very difficult decisions here over the next several months of trying to find those dollars. And so we're never going to grow based on that kind of a formula. Other states that have grown have found alternative mechanisms, whether it's a formula-based funding like Missouri or Arizona that's based on a percentage of dollars that are generated through leisure and hospitality and industry businesses that's dedicated to tourism, or a statewide lodging tax or things like that. We don't have that. We have to basically compete with the general fund. We do also have to bring in dollars from the private sector in order to get the incentive, and that's something that makes us a little bit different, is we're not trying to do it alone. We're trying to bring money in from the private sector as well. But I guess that goes to the point of your question. Are we going to recommend anything further beyond that? Well, unless we get specific directions, no, at that point. Those are our recommendations. You also asked about the non-tax revenue. As for non-general revenue fund streams, we're a public-private entity whose mission is to help generate non-general fund dollars to support our programs. We're required as a part of our match to bring in non-general fund dollars to the state. And so while some of our reductions are based on revenue, in fact, when we looked at how much we had unspent, that included some of the revenue that we brought in, and that included the reduction of that as well. So then I guess the other thing that you mentioned, federal match, you asked about that. With the recommendations of the governor does not have any impact on any federal matching dollars, so this will not affect that. And I think the last question that you asked regarding any other policy changes that we'd like to recommend, and I guess, you know, when you ask that question, I'm not sure I should go here with this, but I will anyway. I would urge this committee, when you're looking at legacy dollars for a lot of different programs promoting, basically supporting the arts, promoting natural resources, promoting historic sites, and those are great things. But it doesn't make sense to always continually to build or create more until we market what we already have. So I hope that when you're looking at legacy dollars, that the idea of connecting to people is as important as creating new. So that's the only other policy thought that I had for the committee at this time. But that pretty much, I tried to touch on most of the questions that you asked and give you a quick overview of what the governor's budget is recommending for us, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Mm-hmm. Now, your advice about the legacy dollars, which I can't see that in any of the funds that have that report to us and that we have guidance for in our legislative guide, probably haven't considered at this point in their delivery or in their development, considered whether Explore Minnesota in any way would be eligible or partnering with Explore Minnesota. Maybe they have talked about it, but we haven't heard about it. But what you said the last time you were before us a couple of weeks ago was about the fishing, that we really don't do enough for fishing as a promotion of Minnesota, doesn't promote that enough, or you didn't say enough is my words, but we could do more in promoting fishing and get more people to come and explore other kinds of entertainment, recreation, outdoor resources that Minnesota has that would make people happy to spend time and money in Minnesota. And that's the kind of thing that you were mentioning when you said we should market what we already have.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, and as far as the whole the legacy topic, I work very well with every one of the entities that have been before you, whether it's the Department of Natural Resources, Historical Society, the Arts Board, et cetera. And I know they all have their hands full right now just trying to get this early start on the legacy dollars. I guess my only point is, as we get down the road, several years perhaps down the road, maybe that we need to be working together as a state to market what we currently have and what we're investing in so we can connect it to users, which comes into kind of the mission of my agency is to market Minnesota. And I want to be able to market all the great work of this committee, the use of the legacy dollars and the other agencies, and all of the product that we have. Now, let's just not forget about that piece. At some point, we need to connect people and market the great resources that we have.
And you do that now through the grants program, right?
Madam Chair, yeah, the grants program basically is a partnership grant program. It's about $750,000 that we give to grants to do their own local marketing, which is just more of a destination organization type of program. So a lot of what we do, a lot of the marketing of the arts and of natural resources and things like that right now. But as we, as an agency and all the different agencies before you this session, have fewer and fewer dollars, I think more and more partnership. We got to think about collaboration. And I guess really that's the bottom line of my plea. It's let's just collaborate and try to work together because we all have the same things in mind, the same goals, and perhaps there's something we can do here down the road.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Jim Gullickson, Association of Minnesota Public and Education Radio Stations, AMPERS.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me. Chair Murphy, distinguished representatives, for the record, my name is Jim Gullickson. I am the AMPERS president and the manager of KMSU-FM at Minnesota State University Mankato. Thank you for allowing me this opportunity to testify on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations, or AMPERS. We've provided you with a modest packet of materials that gives some background on AMPERS as well as supporting the testimony I'll share with you today. AMPERS stations have received state community service grants and equipment grants for about 30 years, since 1980. And over this period of time, the Minnesota State Legislature has wisely recognized the importance of these stations as valuable resources for their communities. The legislature has also consistently recognized how vitally important these grants are to the individual stations in order to provide radio service needs that are not met by commercial broadcasters. And there are some unique things that AMPERS stations do for their communities. For instance, emergency communication. Our friends at WTIP up on the North Shore have done on a number of occasions some really wonderful things to help the listeners along that area who needed to get information about wildfires and more recently an issue with a communication breakdown that occurred when a fiber optic cable was actually cut in Duluth but affected the entire North Shore area. And WTIP jumped to attention, started working hard on communicating with folks about how to get emergency telephone service rerouted. All the 911 service went down. And there's a supporting letter from the sheriff in your packet of materials about that particular episode. Also foreign language. You know, AMPERS stations provide foreign language programming. Certainly not a commercially viable kind of thing, but important for those communities. Somali, Orono, Ojibwe, Hmong. We even provide at our station 6 hours of Spanish language programming for the Latino audience, which is somewhat sizable in South Central Minnesota. State grants provide a very important part of the financing for AMPERS public radio stations. The AMPERS stations vary considerably in size, and the state grants make up from anywhere from 2.3% all the way up to 36% of the various station budgets. Some of the impacts that these grants have on the stations, if the current proposal from the governor should go through and these grants are zeroed out, This would force some stations to drastically reduce or even eliminate labor-intensive activities such as live broadcasts from major events, coverage of state and local activities, and even employment at the Ember stations of students interested in pursuing a career in broadcasting. The stations would not be able to offer the variety and depth of cultural and minority program that serves unique listener groups. They wouldn't be able to stay current with technology, which is, as you know, changing constantly. And for the stations that train public broadcasters, that means not having the equipment that those folks would eventually use in their careers after graduation. Unfortunately, some stations would most likely have to lay off employees or significantly decrease their hours of work at the stations and decrease the quality of the broadcasts. There's an extra added burden for those Amper stations that receive grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and this is similar to what the folks from public television were telling you, in that the Amper stations that qualify for CPP grants do so with non-federal dollars, and those state grants certainly apply to those non-federal dollars. So it's vitally important that those stations are able to reach those thresholds. So it boils down to jobs in many respects. And these state community service and equipment grants ultimately make it possible for bright, creative Minnesotans to work at Amper stations and serve their communities. Now, as the distinguished members of the House Committee all know, in November of 2008, Minnesota voters approved the Legacy Amendment to the state constitution. And because of your hard work last session, Amper stations were ultimately granted an estimated $2.65 million of the Lessard SAMS legacy proceeds to enhance the arts and cultural heritage for all Minnesotans. And we have not taken that lightly.
Excuse me.
Yes, sir. Yes, yes, Madam Chair.
This was out of the Constitutional Amendment 3/8 funds. Nothing
correct
to do with the Lessard SAMS legacy council.
Madam Chair, I apologize.
That's okay. We just kind of don't want to get confused.
Well,
some people think that all the 3/8 money is the Lessard SAMS Council. It's not. That's just 1/4.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
It's more than that in the amount of money, but it is the money that you received came out of the history, culture, arts funding.
19.7.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
19.7.
Thank you.
Yes.
For that clarification, Madam Chair. In regard to that, we were very deliberate, Ampers was, in making certain that the dollars from that particular fund would be used to create new or enhance existing programming and to vigorously improve arts and cultural heritage access for all Minnesotans rather than going toward general operating expenses. And that's the point I was trying to make, is that we have entered into grant agreements with the Department of Administration that outlines the specific use for those funds, and we're very careful to not designate any of those funds for our general operating expenses.
Because you knew you could not supplant.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As our record has demonstrated since the inception of the State Community Service and Equipment Grants programs, Amper stations have been and will continue to be excellent stewards of these funds. And since we all recognize the seriousness of the current and future budget issues facing the state of Minnesota, and our record demonstrates that in previous downturns in the economy, we have shouldered some of the burden. And so we would just ask you today to consider, rather than zeroing us out on these state operating and equipment grants, that you would instead allow us to simply shoulder a fair share of the burden. That is my testimony, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the time and your help in getting through that.
Thank you. Mr. Cullickson, you talked about the stations that educate public broadcasters or train public broadcasters. Do all the 12 stations do that, or just some of them?
Madam Chair, just some of the stations do that as a regular course of their day-to-day activities. Some more deliberately than others. For instance, I'm at an educational institution, so the students that are involved in our day-to-day activities are sharpening their skills and for a purpose. But you know, some stations, community licensed stations, for instance, might have high school students or other groups from their community involved in production of broadcast, but not necessarily specifically for an educational purpose.
And Mr. Gullickson, what did you mean by CPP grants?
Oh, CPB. That would be the federal grants that are awarded to stations that qualify. And again, it's meeting those non-federal dollar thresholds. The folks from public television talked about the same kind of thing. And some of the amper stations are faced with those same issues when applying for those CPB grants. Okay. Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
How, and you also mentioned that the suggested cuts would affect the number of jobs. Do you have a total, or do you?
I believe there's some indication of that in the materials that were passed out.
Okay.
If you would like more detailed information, we certainly would be more than happy to provide that to the committee.
No, I'll go back. If it's in there, that's good. Any other questions? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the time.
Minnesota Public Radio, Jeff Nelson, Lisa Radzak. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Radzak.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair.
For the record, my name is Lisa Radzak. I am the Community Engagement Manager at Minnesota Public Radio. I'm joined at the table by Jeff Nelson, NPR's Managing Director for Public Strategy. Thank you again for having us. We want to provide you with more information about how the governor's supplemental budget proposal, cutting NPR's FY11 general fund appropriation by 100%, will have very real consequences for Hinckley, International Falls, Ely, and other greater Minnesota communities that surround these cities. As importantly, we want you to be aware of how the cuts to our general fund appropriation will negatively impact the matching federal dollars that we currently receive. I want to turn it over now to Jeff Nelson, who is here to provide you with additional details about the impacts of the governor's proposal.
Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Jeff Nelson. I'm the Managing Director of Public Strategy at Minnesota Public Radio. And of course, first, I want to thank you for the trust that you gave to Minnesota Public Radio in appropriating these dollars in the first place. But I do want to talk about what the effects of a 100% cut to our general fund dollars will have. I won't restate the good arguments that our colleagues in public broadcasting have already made. We're really standing together on this one. Public broadcasting matters and is important to this state, and so we certainly hope that you will seriously look at restoring funding or a recommendation to restore funding for all public broadcasters in Minnesota. Our situation is somewhat different. Minnesota Public Radio does not use our general fund appropriation for operating dollars. We use our general fund appropriation to build and maintain our statewide network. You look down the hill and you see Minnesota Public Radio and the radio that's being made there, and you see studios and people making programming. But there's something else that's happening every day, and that's we're maintaining 36 stations throughout the state, and that's a very expensive process and requires both a lot of personnel, engineers, broadcast engineers, as well as capital to expand that network. We feel like access to public broadcasting is something that's vitally important, and we have, as part of our mission and part of our values, to try to make sure that our signal is available to as many Minnesotans as possible. And there has been a partnership that has developed between the state of Minnesota and Minnesota Public Radio and the federal government to make sure that that signal gets to as many people as possible. Now, it's not just because of our programming. Of course, we like our programming, the arts, cultural, news, and information programming that we produce 24 hours a day. It's also so that every Minnesotan has access to emergency alerts, amber alerts, severe weather reports, and all the other things that come with having access to a public broadcasting system. So the federal government agrees. And as part of our 2010-2011 appropriation, we're planning to build new stations in Ely, Tinkley, and International Falls. And the federal government stepped up and is matching the state appropriation of $500,000 with $600,000 from the National Telecommunications Infrastructure Administration. And the federal government does this for a reason. They also believe that every American should have access to a public broadcasting signal. And so they look at areas of the country where there is not currently access to that signal, and that's where they make their investments. So in Minnesota, it's areas where you can't currently get the NPR signal or get the Ampers, one of the Ampers station signals. And so that's why the federal government has made this $600,000 investment. So that kind of puts us between a rock and a hard place. The rock would be the federal funding. If we lose the our FY11 appropriation, it'll make it very difficult for us to complete these three new stations, and it's very likely that we'll have to turn away some of that federal funding. And when it comes to, we also have funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting for these stations. In that case, we'll actually be cutting a check back to the federal government because we already have those funds in hand. The hard place is the Federal Communications Commission. In order to build a new station, you have to wait for the FCC to have a window to apply for new stations, and you sort of jump on stations in areas where you don't currently have a signal. And then they, if you're lucky, they give you a license and a construction permit. And that construction permit has a deadline. And on the handout that you have in front of you, it shows you the deadline for these three new stations. Fortunately or unfortunately, the FCC has a longstanding policy. They do not extend construction permits. If these stations are not built, we lose the license and we have to start over, and it's quite likely that we'll never be able to build these particular stations again. And so that makes it very difficult for us to, we can't push these projects back. You know, in a different situation, we might say, you know, this is capital money, we could just forgo this year and we'll just move all the projects back. Unfortunately, that just is not the reality with these projects. And of course, as you know, we cannot use legacy funding for these projects as well. So that is the situation. Every dollar of state funding that's invested in these projects is matched with over a dollar from the federal government. These are important stations that will reach Minnesotans that don't currently have access to a public radio signal, and we hope that you will consider restoring at least a significant portion of that. We certainly understand that everyone needs to take some cuts this year, but looking around at what other similarly situated general fund recipients are looking at, we feel like 100% cut is disproportionate, and that it's not the way that it should be handled this year. And with that, we can answer any questions.
Mr. Nelson, say that first sentence, if you can. You use the money from the state for your statewide network?
Right. We use our general appropriation to build and maintain our stations in greater Minnesota. And so one of the challenges that we have is maintaining this network is very expensive, and some of these stations they wouldn't make sense economically were it not for state support. And federal support, absolutely. And so that's really where this partnership is what makes these stations possible.
And how many stations do you have in greater Minnesota?
The number keeps changing. 36 is the number, the latest. And that doesn't include translators. That's just full power stations.
Okay. And that doesn't include International Falls, Hinkley, and Ely?
Correct. It does include Roseau War Road, which is the station that funding from the last biennium helped us build. And that's on the air right now.
And so how many people is that?
We have, Madam Chair, we have 950,000 listeners each week to our regional services. And over a third of those are in greater Minnesota.
And the AMPR, Mr. Gullickson, you might want to come back if you have anything to add, but I'm confused about the public safety aspect, the AMBER alerts and the other public safety. If we reduced or if we do not, if we went along with the governor's supplemental recommendation, then what would happen to the public knowing about missing people or tornado warnings coming or whatever? Who would do that?
Madam Chair, on behalf of AMPRs, I would say that you know, we rely actually on Minnesota Public Radio for much of that EAS and statewide alert system. So we repeat what they generate, and couldn't do without their support. But in the example of WTIP that I made before, I know that they wanted to use some of the grant money that's earmarked that may not arrive if things go the way that they could. To actually purchase a de-icer for their antenna system. And what that does is keeps them on the air, because if ice builds up on your antenna, you go off the air. And that could be pretty detrimental for those listeners up in that neck of the woods, particularly during an ice storm when, you know, power could be an issue and a lot of other emergency situations could come into play. So that's just an example.
Thank you. Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, just to add to what Mr. Gullickson said, Minnesota Public Radio is the backbone of the statewide emergency alert system. So all the broadcasters in the state tune in, except for in the Twin Cities. WCCO in the Twin Cities is also part of the system. But in greater Minnesota, because we have such a robust network, we were chosen to be the backbone of the EAS. All other broadcasters, commercial, non-commercial, tune in to our signal, and then we then populate the emergency alert comes out over our signal, and then we in essence sort of take over their signal. So right now 95% of the state can get Minnesota Public Radio signal, and so within that area we're able to provide that service. In these areas where we don't currently have a strong signal, we're not. So it's just a matter of, nothing would change, it's just we would not be making the improvements that we need to make sure that everyone has access to that signal, and other broadcasters have access to it as well.
Thank you. Other questions, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to our guests, I'm still trying to understand the technology of radio. So I figure as long as you're going to keep using words that I don't understand, I'll just ask the question. Maybe there's a few other people who don't understand. And that is, you talked about how you have 36 stations and you want to add these three stations, which I assume is to help fill that 10% gap. Mm-hmm. But then you talked about translators, and I see the AMPRs people talk about translators. So can you tell me, is it like everyone in the state gets the same content? It's just a technology that will, you know, send the radio signals farther and penetrate more areas, or is this actually hiring new people and they're going to have local programming and they'll have kind of a, you know, NPR of the North, or, you know, what? Tell me exactly kind of what the difference is, because I'm a little confused.
Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I've been at Minnesota Public Radio 5 years now, and I just learned that the transmitter's on the ground and the antenna's in the air. So I'm learning these things, but the difference, my understanding, the difference between a full power station and a translator is a relatively low power station that's picking up another signal and then just rebroadcasting it. And so it's a relatively easy technology to just get a signal to an area. So in Hinckley, for example, we have a translator on the water tower that you can see as you're driving up 35, and what that translator is actually doing is tuned in to the Twin Cities KNOW signal. Now it can just pick it up weekly, but because it's professional equipment, it can pick it up and then rebroadcast in Hinkley. But it's a relatively small signal, and it's also not as protected by the FCC as a full power station would be. And so if you just were to look at circles on the map, a full power station would be a bigger circle, reach tens of thousands more people. It's also protected by the FCC so that you're more likely to have a clean signal within that broadcast area. So we translators for us are always sort of a transition. We're always trying to get to full power stations because that's where we're truly providing the kind of service that you would expect. Did that answer your question?
Madam Chair, just one quick follow-up. Do those stations have unique programming, or are they still just a bigger, better, more reliable conduit of the main program?
Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, the programming is pretty much the same. A translator is usually identical to whatever the service is that it's picking up. A full power station, we are able to have some slight variations in a full power station, but for the most part, aside from weather, our weather is different no matter where you are in the state. We're always changing the weather, but for the most part, our service is a regional service.
How much do you buy from other states? How much programming do you buy from other states?
Madam Chair, I can get you an exact number. I will say of public radio stations nationally, we are by far one of the leading providers of local programming. We provide over 50 hours of local programming a week that originates here in Minnesota. And so if you were to go to public radio stations around the nation, you'd be hard-pressed to find a station that provides that much local programming. And as you know, we are also a national distributor and broadcaster. We reach 16 million people a week with our national programming. And so one of the nice things is that we're not buying that programming from other stations because we're producing it ourselves.
But you're not producing What Do You Know?
There's some other excellent programming out there that we don't produce.
And you, this local programming, do you sell to other states or other systems across the country?
Madam Chair, certainly some of our programming a lot of programming that originates here, we do sell to other stations around the country. And then some of our programming is very Minnesota specific. Mid-morning, midday, these are programs that are very much about Minnesota. It's highly unlikely that anyone in North Dakota or elsewhere would want to buy it. Although we do broadcast all that programming in some of our stations outside of Minnesota, just because why not? And then we do have quite a bit of national programming that originates here that is purchased by stations around the country.
And Mr. Nelson, how much federal money is in jeopardy if we accept the supplemental budget recommendations?
Madam Chair, we currently have it's $600,000 from the NTIA, the National Telecommunications Infrastructure Administration, for the $500,000 appropriation from the state. So if we were to lose the second $250,000, we would find a way. I mean, we are not going to let all that federal money go. So we'd have to very quickly figure out how to best retain the federal funding. So I can't tell, we wouldn't lose the whole $600,000. That would be crazy. We would find a way to hold on to as much as possible, but we would certainly lose a significant piece of it. One of the challenges, we can't move the federal money around projects. If we can't do one project, we can't say, oh, let's apply that to another project. That federal funding stays with the station.
Right. Do your individual stations, can they qualify for the $600,000 too?
Madam Chair, do you mean the stations in Greater Minnesota?
Yeah, the 36 stations.
All of the stations are Minnesota Public Radio, so there's not an individual organization for those stations. They are all wholly owned by.
So Minnesota it can't Public be 36 600,000s. It's just one 600,000.
You know, if we could find a way to do that, I'm sure we would. But so far, we haven't.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Minnesota Humanities Commission, Mr. Romanstein. You've been here before. Same situation.
I have, Madam Chair.
So you will expect a practice delivery tonight. Welcome. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not used to having so many people walk out when I begin.
Oh, that's those broadcasters, you know.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to speak briefly this afternoon about the impact of Governor Pawlenty's proposed cuts in state support for the Minnesota Humanities Center. For the record, my name is Stanley Romanstein, and I am the Minnesota Humanities Center's president. The Minnesota Humanities Center currently receives a general fund appropriation of $250,000 per year. Governor Pawlenty's budget proposal would eliminate all general fund support for the Minnesota Humanities Center's work, and not just in fiscal 2011, but for the coming biennium as well. If the governor's recommendations stand, the Humanities Center would be forced to eliminate 7 full-time staff positions. That's a quarter of our current staff. And we would be compelled to close the Humanities Education Center. If you have not visited our building, we have a vibrant retreat center on the east side of St. Paul. We occupy the former west wing of the original Gillette Children's Hospital. We're the only non-residential building in the Payne-Phelan neighborhood, and we serve as a real anchor for the Payne-Phelan neighborhood. Closing the Humanities Education Center and eliminating 7 staff positions would severely limit our ability to deliver rigorous professional development opportunities to thousands of K-12 educators across our state. We provide the kind of professional development that's proving to close the academic achievement gap between Minnesota's underserved kids and their classmates all across our state. But as potentially devastating as those actions would be, the brunt of Governor Pawlenty's recommendations would be borne disproportionately, I think, by organizations in greater Minnesota with which we work. Organizations like...
Are we there? No?
That's all right. Alexandria Community Education, Northern Exposure to Lifelong Learning in Bagley, the Blooming Prairie Branch Library, the Wright County Historical Society in Buffalo, the Minnesota Discovery Center in Chisholm, the Crookston Library, the Dassel Area Historical Society, Unlimited Learning in Deerwood, the Detroit Lakes Public Library, Duluth Public Schools, East Grand Forks Campbell Library, the Ottertail County Historical Society in Fergus Falls, Gaylord Public Library, the Minnesota Machinery Museum in Hanley Falls, the Ivanhoe Public Library, the Lackey Parle Historical Society in Madison, the Menomen Library, the Learning Unlimited Organization in Morris, Minnesota, Tri-County Living at Home in New Folden, the Cannon Valley Elder Collegium in Northfield, Headwaters Center for Lifelong Learning in Park Rapids, the History Museum of East Ottertail County in Perham, the Roseau County Historical Society, the Clearwater County Historical Society in Shevlin, Spring Grove Public Library, the University of the Third Age in St. Cloud, the Pennington County Historical Society in Thief River Falls, organizations like the Zumbrota County Historical Society and the Leif Erikson Lodge and Sons of Norway in Vining. You might ask, well, how could the elimination of only $250,000 in annual state support for the Humanities Center so negatively impact not only the Humanities Center, but about 40 other organizations that are dotted across Minnesota's landscape?
The state's general fund appropriation accounts for only 6% of the Humanities Center's $4.2 million annual operating budget. But that modest investment from the state enables us to qualify for $550,000 in federal funds through the National Endowment for the Humanities and to leverage about $2.7 million a year from corporations, foundations, and individuals. Corporations, foundations, and individuals ask us specifically about the level of state support that we receive. If the level of state support is strong, if it's stable, if it's significant, foundations and corporations are more than willing to enter into partnership with us, and they've proven that over time. If state support vanishes altogether, however, then federal support falls away, and with the loss of federal and state support, our partnerships with corporations and foundations also begin to weaken and are in serious jeopardy. In short, if you withdraw state support, everything about the Minnesota Humanities Center's funding becomes at risk and becomes seriously at risk very, very quickly. We pride ourselves on creating public-private partnerships in order to do our work, but if you withdraw the public, there is no public-private partnership. It's true that through the generosity of this committee, the state has also entrusted the Minnesota Humanities Center with funds created through the Legacy Amendment. We're proud, we're profoundly grateful for those funds and for the important work that we're able to do through those funds, but the reality is that legacy funds don't keep our lights on, they don't provide basic operating support for the Minnesota Humanities Center, the kind of operating support that we desperately need. It's the general fund appropriation that meets that need, and we will be in rather dire straits if that appropriation disappears. The Minnesota Humanities Center, as I hope you know and would agree, is an important part of the state's arts, history, and cultural heritage ecosystem. We do understand the depth of the fiscal challenge that Minnesota faces, and we want to do our part to create a sustainable solution. The governor's recommendations reduce most other state agencies' budgets by 3-6%, but the Humanities Center's appropriation by 100%. One might interpret the governor's actions as an attempt to supplant general fund support with legacy fund support, but as this committee is well aware and has noted on other occasions, doing so is expressly forbidden by the language of the constitutional amendment adopted by the citizens of Minnesota. In short, the impact of the governor's recommendation to eliminate all general fund support would have a devastating effect on the Humanities Center. The brunt would be felt, I think, disproportionately by organizations in greater Minnesota, organizations spread throughout the state, and the real cost savings to the state budget would be minimal. I would hope that you would reject the governor's recommendations and that you would hold the Humanities Center to the same standard that you hold other agencies that fall under your jurisdiction. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Romenstein. It says in the handout about this education center. How long have you been providing this service to teachers of the humanities in the state, and why isn't this a service that's done by the Department of Education? How did that come about? Can you help me out there?
Mr. Romenstein.
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, we have been providing professional development to K-12 educators since 1971, and we have most often worked in partnership with the Department of Education in providing specific content-based professional development to teachers in the breadth of the humanities topics, in history, languages, literature, social studies, civics. The Department of Education quite often thinks of us as a unique provider. When the legislature revised our state education standards, the Department of Education turned to us and said, we need to equip elementary teachers to implement the social studies standards by teaching literature and history in a more aggressive fashion, and they sent us out around the state to do that. So we do work in partnership with them.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Does the money that you raise for programming and so forth, is that sufficient to carry out your programs?
Madam Chair, it's not sufficient to carry out our programs. Our programs would be severely diminished if we were left only to private support, if we were only dependent upon fundraising. And it would mean the elimination of almost all of the support that we provide in greater Minnesota. We would be reduced to providing only professional development for K-12 educators out of offices somewhere in the, probably in the Twin Cities, and we would end up doing most of it online and not face-to-face with teachers across the state.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The Amateur Sports Commission, Mr. Erickson. It's a long time since we've seen you. But former Representative Carlson and your board member has represented you very well here. But welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's nice to be back. Yeah. And it's been a long time, but it's getting better. I think the true barometer whether I'm when I get 100% is when I can join Leon on the hockey rink again. And I think I'm a few months away from that, but hopefully someday.
They could have used
maybe.
You last night.
Yeah, they could have used you last night. Thank you for coming and to respond to the governor's supplemental budget recommendations.
Yeah, Madam Chair, by comparison, I think we're spared, you know, to a lesser extent than some of these other fine agencies. But just so you know, what we've done, the agency now, I mean, in the old days, we had 10 staff and lots of other things. Today, we have 3 staff, and the board that once met monthly is now meeting quarterly to save expenses, and we cut back on a bunch of little things. We're down to the point that any more cuts and we basically lose a staff person. So I want to let everyone know that I think the agency has a reputation of being entrepreneurial and creative. Hennepin County, through the Twin Stadium, had a grant component where they give out $2 million a year. And because our agency had 15 years of grant-making experience through Mighty Kicks, Mighty Ducks, so we made a bid for that and received that account. Now, that enabled us a year ago when we were reduced from 300 to 270 that we take $30,000 from Hennepin County grant program to retain that third staff person so we don't reduce that person to half time. So basically this most recent cut of 4,000 in the first year of the biennium and second, 8 in the second, we're just going to take more of that administrative proceed. But what, just so everyone knows, the Hennepin County is not subsidizing the Amateur Sports Commission. We're providing a fee for service. So instead of having 3 staff people who work 100% for the state's mission through the Amateur Sports Commission, we have 2.5 or 2.4 after this latest. But the good news is it retains a quality professional staff person so that, you know, because you can't retain a quality person if you only have a third or a half-time position for them. And I think it does do a good thing that our experience in grant-making does a great job for Hennepin County. We've already done one round for them, and I think they were very pleased that it was very professionally done. And the other good news is it obviously saves the state of Minnesota that amount of money as well. But it's not ideal. But I think by comparison to many of these other agencies, our agency is very workable, as we found this non-state source of funds. And even though we're losing the work of one of our 3 staff people, we can retain that quality person. So that's how we would handle the cuts, Madam Chair.
And you, Hennepin County is going to continue to...
Yes, the contract is for 5 years. So we'll have that portion of that third person for up to 5 years, and then it could go beyond that. If they like the work we're doing, it could be renewed and go even further.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank you, and it's nice to see you again, Madam Chair, and the rest of the committee. It's a
glad
welcome
that
sight after being
recovering
gone.
So well.
Thank you.
Minnesota Department of Education Libraries, Suzanne Miller, the State Librarian, Amy Wallstein, the Government Relations Director. Welcome back, Ms. Miller. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Wallstein.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Amy Wallstein. I'm the Government Relations Director for the Minnesota Department of Education. And I'm here to introduce Suzanne Miller, who's our Director of the Libraries Division. And she's going to walk you through the effects of the supplemental budget on libraries.
Ms. Miller.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and representatives. I was asked to discuss the effect of the governor's budget on libraries, and it's rather a varied list of things. At the beginning is, of course, that the Department of Education and therefore the Division of State Library Services as subject to the across-the-board cut of 3% for operating budgets for the agencies. This will, of course, have an impact on our services that we have available to meet the needs of libraries across the state. The governor's budget itself does not recommend any changes to library aid program funding. These include regional library basic system support, regional telecom communications aid, multi-type, multi-county systems, and the K-12 share of the Electronic Library of Minnesota. And for this, the library community is extremely grateful. We are very happy that there were no cuts recommended in the governor's budget. The 2773 funding shift or aid payment deferral does affect regional libraries, however. The regional library systems do depend upon this aid. They may face and will have to handle short-term cash flow situations. These organizations do not typically have extensive reserves, and they do not have the ability to engage in short-term borrowing. The governor's bill does not include the library accessibility and construction requests for the bonding bill. Without these grants, local governments will be less likely to move ahead with planned construction for libraries. Construction has a long-term effect on our access to library services. The University of Minnesota was also subject to state budget reductions. Minitex, that operates under the University of Minnesota, provides statewide library services. The services include funding for Electronic Library of Minnesota, MinLink, interlibrary loan and delivery support, backup reference, and library training and support for all types of libraries, not just university libraries. And that is a partnership between State Library Services and the Minitex, where the funding comes both from state and federal resources. The question regarding the impact, the actual impact on Minitex, would have to be addressed to the university personnel. Local government officials will need to address their plans in the face of reductions in local government aid and county program aid. However, the economic effect of this reduced revenue could have downstream effects on funding for libraries at the local level. Last legislative session, libraries supported a modification in the certified level of library support. This allows cities and counties to ask for a recertification of their level of support based on the percentage of the reduction of city and county program aid. I actually have a handout here. This is a spreadsheet which shows the impact of the in 2009 of this aid reduction. In 2009, 12 cities and 7 counties requested recertification under the new law. 2 of them did not qualify because they were already at the minimum level of support acceptable under current statutes. The cumulative reduction you will see in the is about $772,000. Just in last year alone. We'll know the actual reductions that will be implemented in July. This represents only the recertified amount. We won't know if those cities or counties actually took those reductions until we get our final numbers in July of this year. As of today, we have 2 counties and 4 cities that have requested reductions or recertifications for fiscal year 2010, and those have just begun to come in. Some of the inquiries we have received due to financial reductions across Minnesota include inquiries on reducing open requirements to below the 20 hours per week that are required for the regional library telecommunications aid. We've had inquiries on closing libraries, what's the procedure, and we've have been asked about how to merge city library levies into county library levies. This is just a quick overview, and I'm open to questions.
Ms. Miller, the maintenance of effort or the recalculations and the certifications that you were just speaking of, that is in addition to the 3%?
The 3% is only an operational reduction for the agency, so that only affects my office, the Division of State Library Services, which includes the Braille and Talking Book Library.
Okay.
These recertifications would be the local funding, county and city funding for local libraries.
Right, and this is what we worked out together with Representative Lanning.
Correct.
Apparently, that on the overall, there was going to be all the maintenance of effort kind of proposals, but it seems like the libraries were the only ones that responded and worked it out with the local communities.
Certainly the libraries want to be partners.
Yep.
There's a recognition that we need to be partners in this and not the only people held harmless. It doesn't change the fact that libraries they are affected by this.
And they did it in 2009,
correct.
And the requests are just coming in now for 2010.
Right.
The cities and the counties are asking for recertification now under the agreement that...
The 2010 certified level of support was, the letters went out in August 2009. We send out the letters before the levies are set so that the counties and cities know what to set their levy, where they need to set their levies. So the recertifications cannot go out until we have the numbers from the Department of Revenue on the change or reduction in local program aid or CPA. We just received those changes, so now we're ready to accept changes or recertification for 2010.
And what is the governor's proposed supplemental budget due to the Braille and Talking Book Library?
Well, the Braille and Talking Book Library is part of my division at the state agency. We have a full operation in Faribault. And my reductions for my division, if we are the 3%, will have to somehow come from either my division here in Roseville or from Faribault. There is very little place that I can, there's not much leeway for me to take a reduction at this point other than to reduce staff somewhere in my division.
And how many staff do you have in Roseville?
In Roseville there's five librarians, which includes myself, and a clerk.
Five librarians, one clerk.
Right.
What do you have in Faribault?
I have seven staff. Seven staff members plus two temporary positions. One of which we know will be suspended at the end of June, and the other one we can continue to maintain until September, because we're restricted under union rules to 1 year employment on a temporary basis.
Madam Chair.
So seven staff, two temp, one
and a half
ending
time
in June, half time.
The half time person is our janitorial service.
Madam Chair.
Representative Paz.
To our testifier, are those actual people or are those positions?
Representative Haas, that is actual positions that are currently filled.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Representative Haas.
Are those
Is there open positions now not filled?
Yes. Our capacity 5 years ago was we had 12.5 filled positions 5 years ago.
Madam Chair, are those positions not filled because you do not have the money or you do not wish to spend the money that you have in that category?
Ms. Miller.
Representative Haas, I do not have the capital. I have not been allocated the amount of money necessary to hire in those positions at this time.
Madam Chair, I asked these questions, as you probably might know why I'm asking the questions, because a while back the governor put a freeze on hiring and the money was coming from a different source, and it wasn't affecting the dollars, it was just affecting the number of employees. Is that a situation that's still occurring?
Ms. Miller.
To my knowledge, the freeze continues.
Yes.
I do have federal funds to hire two of those positions, but at this time the freeze has continued to be absolute.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Wallstein, I want to ask you a question about testimony we heard from Mr. Romanstein. I know you came here to talk about libraries, so if you don't have an answer to my questions right now, I'd be happy to accept your answer in writing at some later time. Mr. Romanstein indicated that for almost 40 years now, the Humanities Center has worked in concert with the Department of Education to provide professional development services to teachers in the humanities all over the state, and as a result of some of these cuts, they'll be severely limited on their ability to do that going forward. Does the Department of Education have a position on this issue? What do you plan to do to fill the gap? What will you not be able to do that you're currently doing? You're going to be facing some budget cuts under the governor's proposal as well. What will you not be able to do that you're currently able to do in order to fill that gap, or is it not a priority for the department? Like I said, a lot of questions there. I don't expect to answer this second, but if you could get back to us with those answers, I'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair, Representative Morgan, we will get back to you with those questions.
Thank you.
Ms. Miller, let me go back to Rep. Haas' questions. So there's federal money that you could use if there wasn't a hiring freeze?
Madam Chair, yes, I have. We continue to allocate the funding. We receive almost $3 million under Library Services and Technology Act funds from the Institute for Museums and Library Services. There are specific guidelines on which kind of staff we can use this funding for. And the customer service staff we can use the federal funds for, and we continue to set aside the funds so that when the freeze or when we're able to hire, that we'll be in a position to move forward. Towards the end of our grant funding cycle, we have not used it for that purpose, then we redirect the funds, but we try to make sure that the funding stays secure so that we can be ready if the situation changes.
What else can you use the funds with at the end of the cycle?
We always keep, there are always libraries and different projects that call for funding. If it's at the right time, we will add money to our competitive grant program. We, a couple of years ago, used some of that funding to fund the Minneapolis Tribune project, for instance. This was a digitization project to digitize very old Minneapolis Tribune newspaper, the complete newspaper, and which has proved to be very beneficial for genealogists, for advertising. We had a doctor come up and say he was very grateful for it because he was doing medical research that it would help with that. So it's been very good for historical research purposes. It's been a very good project for us.
And so you were speaking of the number of staff. If the 3% goes through, I assume then you will have to cut back on staff?
Based on my budget, if 3% of my current operating budget, I would have to cut one staff member.
And would that come from Roseville or Faribault?
It really has to come from Faribault because I don't have this. Half of my staff in Roseville is federally funded also. So I haven't got the leeway to eliminate staff there.
Ms. Miller, are you still going to Faribault to help out?
Not on the regular basis as we were last spring. If they have additional problems or we have additional losses, we may have to pick that up again, but we try not to. It's a lot of driving back and forth.
And then your work in your office.
The work and the regular work doesn't get done there.
Right. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Minnesota Film and TV Board. Ms. Winter, Mr. Anderson, had a busy day,
yeah.
Ms. Winter, huh?
Been multitasking today.
An exciting day?
I was on the set briefly, and most of the members of the Senate committee were able to attend, and I think they got a lot out of going over to the depot to see the movie being shot, so yes.
Good.
It was good.
Welcome, Mr. Anderson. Ms. Winters.
My name for the record is Lucinda Winter. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Film and TV Board. And first of all, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to come and talk about the effects of the governor's proposed budget cuts. Chair Murphy, Vice Chair Morgan, members of the committee. We were asked to address several questions in preparation for this hearing, and we thought it would be easiest if we did so in writing. So we've submitted our answers to those questions in writing, although my testimony will also address them in a more general sense. We got very specific about the answers, and if we're missing anything, of course, we'd be happy to supplement our answers for you. On behalf of the 4,100 men and women who work in Minnesota's film and video industry, we know the choices before the legislature this year are extraordinarily tough. We don't envy your job of allocating cuts and reductions among the state's agencies and commissions. Each one does important work, and each adds to the vitality of our economy and to the quality of life in Minnesota. We understand that the Minnesota Film and TV Board, which supports an industry that provides 4,100 Minnesota jobs and generates more than $225 million in economic activity each year, we're just one of those organizations. We are ready to do our share to try to shore up the deficit. Even so, we believe there are strong arguments that make our work worthy of your continued support, even in these very tough times. The governor's supplemental budget proposal, which cuts all operational funding for the Film and TV Board and eliminates the Snowbait Jobs Program in 2011, means the end of the Film Board and our work. If adopted, the governor's proposal will deal a terrible blow to the film and television industry in our state, will cost our state good-paying jobs, and will diminish our economic vitality. And of a great concern to me, it will also drive more of our young people to leave Minnesota in search of opportunity. We cannot believe these are outcomes that the legislature supports. The Film and TV Board serves an industry that includes electricians, carpenters, animators, writers, educators, designers, photographers, editors, actors, producers, caterers, engineers, and directors, just to name a few of the jobs. It creates work for trucking firms, for hotels, for restaurants and caterers, car and truck rental companies, and hundreds of other businesses. The Film and TV Board is the first stop for a commercial production, a TV series, a feature film, or a documentary that's looking to do business in Minnesota. But we're also an important resource for Minnesota's indigenous production industry. Companies such as Target, Best Buy, Toro, 3M, Polaris, and Marvin Windows and Doors, to name just a few, do many millions of dollars of production work in our state because we have the existing infrastructure here and talent to get the job done. We're the doorway through which 385 Minnesota businesses connect with their customers. Closing our office shuts the door on those businesses and their employees. The Film and TV Board was first funded by the legislature back in 1983 to serve as the state's film commission. Every other state in America, many cities, and nearly every other country in the world has a similar body, the vast majority funded entirely by public money. The Minnesota Film and TV Board is unusual among our peers in that we leverage a modest grant of public funds with private dollars. By statute, we're required to raise $1 of private money in order to receive $3 of public funding. The private money comes first. We've worked hard to keep our costs low and our impact on the state's budget modest. It's worth noting that our current appropriation of $325,000 annually before the governor's proposed cuts is $4,000 less than our 1999 appropriation on an actual dollar basis. Since June of 2007, the Snowbait program that we administer under a separate grant has created 349 full-time equivalent jobs at a cost of $7,700 per job. During that time, and those are full-time equivalent jobs, during that time, Snowbait projects have generated $15,600,000 in direct spending in Minnesota and an additional $15 million in indirect spending. This is a tremendous return on a very modest investment in both absolute terms and relative to what other states invest in similar programs. As of today, we've certified 21 Snowbait projects for fiscal year 2010, the year we're in right now. We estimate these projects will spend more than $5.3 million in direct expenditures in our state and will create an estimate more than, it's hard for us to tell until we actually process the reimbursements when we do our full-time formula, but somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 jobs. Total Snowbait reimbursements earmarked for these projects is $796,000. The governor's proposed reduction of our fiscal year 2010 Snowbait fund to $525,000 means that some of the certified projects currently being produced here, like The Convincer, or planning to go into production in the next few months, will not receive their promised reimbursement. Other projects scheduled to shoot here will move elsewhere and take with them the jobs and economic activity they create. When a film or TV production comes to town, anywhere in Minnesota, hotels, offices, and condos get rented, coffee houses and restaurants experience sales increases, commercial shoots buy hardware, they buy paint and lumber, they buy flowers, hire caterers, visit dry cleaners, and hire security services. Gas stations are busier, hair salons and barbers see more customers in their chairs. Income tax and sales tax revenues increase. Visiting crew members and cast, all of whom are also paying Minnesota income taxes while they're here working, visit our malls, shop on Main Street, buy cars and bicycles. They do all the things that people do when they're visiting a state for what can be months at a time. Closing our office shuts the door on these dollars. For out-of-state production companies, it says, take your business elsewhere. For our in-state producers, it says, we don't support your contribution to our economy. We're here today to ask that the legislature not shut the door on those 4,100 jobs and on the $225 million in economic activity that our industry generates for the state. We ask on behalf of the 385 businesses and their employees and on behalf of the thousands more who provide goods and services to film and production companies across the state. And we are here to ask on behalf of Minnesota citizens who value the arts as part of our state's culture and who have always welcomed those who make their living in the arts. This is a grassroots tradition, one established and nurtured by the citizens of Minnesota, as evidenced by their decisive support for the Legacy Amendment. As you'll see in the documents we've submitted, we have a plan for addressing a 6% reduction in our operations budget and in the amount available for our 2010 Snowbait program. This is in line with the budget reduction we were asked to plan for to address the budget deficit and is consistent with the direction to other state agencies. We're ready to implement these cuts and believe we can still carry out our mission to create jobs and economic growth by promoting and supporting the state's production industry. If it's all right with you, I'd like to thank you, and then ask Bill Anderson to speak, and we could take questions afterwards if that's okay. Bill Anderson, by the way, is on our board of directors and has been for 3 years, and he's with the Best Buy company. I really invited him here so he could provide the perspective of one of our largest employers on the impact of eliminating the state's film office.
Welcome, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Murphy. Thanks, Lucinda, and thank you, members of the committee. I know I'm last on the docket of what I'm sure has been already a very long day, so I just have a couple minutes.
That's all right. We have good endurance records.
All right. Well, I'll be brief nonetheless, just to hedge my bets. I do appreciate the chance to share my thoughts and to paint a picture from the perspective of my company, Best Buy, and I hope demonstrate the value a vibrant production community brings over and above the hard dollar business case Lucinda so clearly framed. I'm Bill Anderson, and I've worked at Best Buy for almost 14 years. My current title is Vice President of Brand, Content, and Creative Strategy, but let me translate from the corporate lexicon. I'm the company video guy. It's a job that has steadily moved from the fringes of the company to its core, as Best Buy has found that the very act of creating digital media content is more and more something that not only supports the businesses we're in, but increasingly is the business we're in. My entire time at the company has been spent building what we call Yellow Tag Productions, Best Buy's own production capability. We produce employee-focused television shows and events and a wealth of customer-facing programs, from television spots to the programming you see in the store when you stop for a minute to check out the HD TVs. We produce hundreds of discrete film and video projects every year, even though Yellow Tag really only consists of about a dozen full-time employees. We have accomplished what we have accomplished by relying on and nurturing a strong production community, what we call our extended production family. I've served on the Minnesota Film and Television Board, as Lucinda said, for about 3 years, and in addition to my board membership, Best Buy further supports the board with an annual $25,000 contribution because, as we said in the letter that accompanied our most recent pledge, we support, quote, its continuing mission to build and promote the economic development of the film and television industry in the state of Minnesota. Best Buy relies upon a strong production community to produce our television ads, in-store programming, and internal Yellow Tag videos. It's in Best Buy's interest to promote the creative and production talent that Minnesota needs in order to keep talented individuals from seeking employment elsewhere, end quote from the letter. As I said before, increasingly a company like Best Buy, and I think we're not alone, by the way, a company that makes its living providing service for consumers at the intersection of art and commerce, and for us it's at the intersection of technology and entertainment, we find that the creation of digital media content is no longer something that we do as a sideline to our core business, but it's in fact becoming part of our core business. We do it because our customers expect us to create and aggregate compelling content to show them what's possible and what's next with the technology that they look to us to explain and provide access to. We're increasingly aware that we are in fact a media company, a business that lives alongside our retail business in a mutually reinforcing way. During the last 12 months, Yellow Tag Productions spent more than $17 million in production costs, the vast majority of that money going to production and post-production companies and independent contractors right here in Minnesota. We expect that number to go up this year as we build better media platforms for our customers to engage with this content in-store, online, and literally in the palms of their hands on mobile devices. To be clear, we don't apply for or benefit directly from the production rebate known as Snowbait. Instead, we benefit more generally from a thriving production community and even more generally and importantly from a vibrant creative community, both of which we believe benefit from investments like Snowbait and the Film Commission itself. In an increasingly flat world, a global company like ours can operate anywhere and can locate centers of expertise, such as the creation of film and television content, anywhere, literally anywhere in the world. We are a Minnesota company, proudly, with strong roots here, but we do, out of necessity, look for evidence that our local community is keeping pace with us, willing to invest in itself and in the talent of the people of Minnesota, and, let's be honest, provide incentive for talented people to move to and stay in a state whose average temperature does not compete favorably with that in Los Angeles or even New York. We owe it to our shareholders to do so with a clear eye and not default to the assumption that things like media production or anything else has to be based in Minnesota. The smart, creative production community of the Twin Cities is a big reason I still live here, why I've stayed with Best Buy for 14 years, and seriously, why Best Buy has been successful, in my opinion. The creative output of Yellow Tag and the Minnesota production community has been a significant competitive advantage for my company. An opinion shared by the senior leadership of the company, and that's a fact. It's my personal hope as a native Minnesotan that the state of Minnesota will understand the importance of the production industry, and it's my further hope that the state will demonstrate that understanding by continuing the successful public-private partnership, maintaining a viable film television commission, and investing its resources in this self-sustaining, job-creating industry, which pays back in many ways, direct and indirect. One final side note. I disagree with the opinion I've heard expressed by some that the jobs created by the investment under scrutiny here today are temp jobs. The production community, what I referred to earlier as Yellow Tag's extended family, is in fact a network of small business owners, some independent contractors, and some who run a production rental or post-production shop of maybe a few dozen people, and some who operate somewhere in between, all ready to offer their services when the work emerges. Instead of questioning the quality of this work, I think it should be held up as an example of the way things are supposed to be done in this country. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Mr. Anderson, Yellow Tag, that's the name of the company?
It's what we've called our production capability within Best Buy. We are Best Buy employees. We named it something because it was it made it, frankly, easier to talk about what we did as opposed to, we could have called ourselves the AV Club.
Like at school. Okay, I got it.
And I'm glad we didn't.
And so your job at Best Buy then is to make sure that all the TVs have the same picture on at the same time?
I wish that were true, actually. Very often, they're out of sync, and that drives me crazy.
But that really impressed me when I went to Best Buy the last time to get a new TV, and that they were all in sync. Well, and I thought, how did they do that?
Bless you. That is an investment we've made relatively recently, actually. That content is all created by Yellow Tag Productions in concert with agencies and entertainment studios across the country. And to help us get exclusive content that we believe helps us tell the Best Buy story as it relates to technology and entertainment. That's one piece of work that we do. We also produce television advertising. If you've seen commercials featuring an individual Best Buy employee telling a customer story, that's work that Yellow Tag Productions does. In addition, I'm also responsible increasingly for the work that agencies and other content providers do on behalf of Best Buy. So that is my world.
Are you responsible for, like, the commercials with the Geek Squad van or the Geek Squad little car?
I am responsible for its excellence or lack thereof. Yellow Tag Productions, per se, did not produce that. One of our agency partners produced that content, and part of my job is to be responsible for the work that they do. But to be clear, Yellow Tag Productions is part of a larger ecosystem. As Best Buy grows.
Yes, that's like the third time tonight I've heard ecosystem use. Isn't that interesting how people use that? It's
a
good
thing.
We
need to conserve and protect that.
Yeah, we should. And enhance and protect it. This is a different story.
Madam Chair,
if I could just interject, I think it's surprising, though, to people who aren't familiar with our little ecosystem here, that when you hear that a company like Best Buy spends, was it 17 or 18 million? More than 17 million last year. And what that means is a lot of that went to people who work in the production industry in the state, and they freelance, basically, for Best Buy. So let's say they're doing a Best Buy commercial one week. This week they're working on the Convincer, the feature film. Next week they'll be working on a commercial. This is how the industry, it's a network of people who come together. So Bill doesn't have all these people on staff, but he's working with a lot of the people who have come to this room before and have spoken to you before about the industry. So that's a lot of paychecks that are going out to people in Minnesota who are working in this industry. And I think it is really surprising to people who don't work in the industry to realize that similar numbers probably exist, and I know they do, at companies like Target and other big corporate companies. They do all their communications work here, and the reason they do is because we have the people and the infrastructure to do it.
So what we said last year about the small jobs rather than the big showy film, a full-length film, is our bread and butter.
It really is our bread and butter. I would have to say the most stable segment of our industry, and it's the segment where I made my living before I took this job, is in what we call corporate production. It's consistently, when I do surveys, the most stable part of our industry, and always amounts to many, many millions of dollars. So yes, it's very stable, and the commercials that Best Buy produces would be eligible for snowbait funds, but corporate video production is not eligible. They utilize the Film Commission in other ways, help with locations, help with where do I go for a permit, but they do not utilize snowbait. And yet they rely on us, because without that other work that comes in, like the convincer, those folks over these 30 days are working with a very, very, very top-notch director of photography and crew, and it's on-the-job training, and it sharpens up our skills. So next time they go work for Best Buy, they've had that exposure, and the gaffer is sharper at what he does, the grip is sharper at what she does, the makeup artist just worked hand-in-hand with the makeup artist who taught her some new things. It's really, I think, important that they have the exposure of the productions that we get through Snowbait, because in effect it's on-the-job training with some people who are working on large productions, and everybody needs that kind of training. Mm-hmm. So, is that
any other questions? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Winter. If I understood you correctly, we have lined up a bunch of productions that are counting on or expecting this rebate. And if you could get us some information about the size of those and, you know, the risk of us losing those, if we're not able to continue that, where the commitments are and how they move forward, that would be useful.
Sure, I can do that. I'd be happy to. Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson, Ms. Winters. Is it still going on?
I think so.
Or do you have an announcement?
Would you like to invite them down?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you are interested, I'm sorry, I forgot. If you are interested and have the energy, you're more than welcome to come to the Union Depot, where filming continues on the convincer. And on set today are Greg Kinnear and Billy Crudup, and I think Alan Arkin is in a scene too. And I just checked before I came on, I can check again, they're still very much going, and there's a van available to take you over there. If anybody's interested, you are more than welcome to come over and see. It's quite impressive to see. It's a very large setup, and there's a lot of people. There's probably over 130 people working right now on that set. Mm-hmm. So if anybody has an interest, just let me know, and we can... the van will be out front and can bring you back as well. It's much easier than parking down there.
Yeah.
So thank you. Let me know. I'll be right here.
Thank you. Representative Morgan, minutes?
Madam Chair, I would like to move approval of the minutes from February 22 and February 24.
Representative Morgan moves the adoption of the committee minutes from February 22nd and February 24th as they are printed. Are there any additions or corrections? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The minutes are adopted as printed. The agenda of the response to the governor's supplemental budget recommendations will continue on Wednesday, and hopefully we will finish up. We've got four more to go.
I didn't know you had a hammer. I'm going to change my vote to yes.
It's too late now.
It's too late.
This meeting is adjourned.